From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The U.S. job market continued to improve last month, but at a slower pace than the month before. The Labor Department said today the unemployment rate fell to 10.2%. Last night, Democrats and Republicans in Congress, though, failed to reach a deal to help the millions of people who have lost extended unemployment benefits and protections from being evicted. Joining us is Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa. Tolu, with no deal in sight in Congress, attention turns to President Trump. He is weighing executive orders on payroll tax cuts and on protection from evictions. Is he, though, backing an extension of unemployment benefits?
Well, he's looking at different options. Now, obviously, if Congress were to pass a bill, that would be the cleanest and the best way to do something like that. But the president is looking to see if he can use executive authority to extend some of those unemployment benefits. The White House has said that's a priority for him, but it's not something that he can do completely without Congress. So he may be able to do some sort of limited form of an extension, but he is looking at that.
So realistically, what kind of help is there for Americans who are struggling?
Well, it remains to be seen. If Congress is not going to pass a law, it's going to be much more difficult for these millions of Americans who are relying on this extra unemployment benefit to get something from the government without Congress involved. So it's a very limited approach that the president may be able to take. He may be able to get some money into the pockets of these Americans, but it would be much more easy to do this if Congress were to come to some kind of agreement. Without Congress, it's a far shot at best that people would continue to get the benefits that they had been receiving through much of the spring and early summer.
One of the other things on the president's mind is the extraordinary steps he's been taking to ban the Chinese-owned social media apps TikTok and WeChat starting next month. Could you explain why he is taking these measures and why now?
Well, the president has essentially declared a national emergency, saying that these various popular apps that are used for communication and used for entertainment by millions, hundreds of millions of people around the world and tens of millions of Americans are a national security threat because the Chinese Communist Party essentially has influence over the Chinese companies that own these apps. And the president is saying that these apps have to be essentially banned in order to protect Americans' data from being under the purview of the Chinese Communist Party. So that's what the president is saying. Obviously, this will potentially end up with some litigation, but it's a pretty drastic action because these apps that are used widely across the country for a number of different reasons would be banned under these executive orders. And that would take a couple of the most popular apps from on the app stores. It would take them out of the market, and that would have a major impact on the way that people communicate.
It would be a huge effect. And in the meantime, is there any kind of corroboration to his assertion that they represent a national security threat?
Well, it is true that China does have a lot of influence over the companies that operate in China, and that if China wanted to ask those companies to hand over information about Americans, that it's possible that those companies would comply. But it is also curious that the president is pushing this at the same time that he has gotten much more antagonistic towards China after the coronavirus pandemic, which the president blamed China for, and the lack of follow through on the trade deal that the president notched last year. So there are people who say that the president is doing this as a retaliation against China because of other issues. But there are some national security concerns as well.
Democrat presidential candidate Joe Biden is facing criticism today for remarks he made suggesting that the black community lacks diversity compared to Hispanics. He put out a series of tweets last night trying to explain the comments. Meanwhile, President Trump says Biden lost the African-American vote with that comment. The president, though, has been falling in the polls. He continued this week to try and spin numbers on the coronavirus death rate, which is climbing. Has the president come out with any new policies that will help states contain the spread of the virus?
Not really. I was with the president yesterday when he was in Ohio. He went to a Whirlpool factory, and he did say that part of his vision for America would include getting control of the pandemic. But in terms of new policies, there was not much that he had to offer other than saying that we're continuing to try to develop a vaccine. He essentially promised a vaccine before Election Day, which most health experts say is unrealistic. So he's continuing to sort of offer positive spin and positive talk about the pandemic without offering a lot of policies for how to get it under control. His health experts are actually trying to come up with ways to increase testing and to open schools and to work through the process. But the president seems to undercut their message by not following those public guidelines.
Thank you for speaking with us, Tolu Olorunipa, Washington Post White House reporter. Thanks again, Tolu.
Thank you.
Let's get some more reaction now to a lawsuit from the New York Attorney General that seeks to dissolve the National Rifle Association. Rob Pincus is executive director of the Personal Defense Network and a member of the NRA, and he's been calling for reform within the organization for years. And Rob, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks, Tanya. It's good to be back. I wish it were under different circumstances.
Well, Rob, as we know, New York Attorney General Letitia James says the NRA is so corrupt, it has to be dissolved. You've been pushing for reform in the organization as part of the group called Save the Second. But do you think this move to dissolve the NRA goes too far?
Well, unfortunately, it's the shoe that was destined to drop because the NRA has not done anything to fix themselves. They have not publicly even really admitted that the problems are anywhere near the scale that they are. Many American gun owners are frustrated. Many NRA members like myself are frustrated. And it's not surprising that the New York State Attorney General has taken this drastic step. It's unfortunate that we're in a position where someone outside of the gun community is attempting to clean up the NRA, which belongs to the gun community.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about those investigation findings. As you said, you have been very critical of CEO Wayne LaPierre for quite some time. This investigation found that the NRA was, quote, fraught with fraud and abuse. It says that the senior leadership of the organization routinely diverted money from its charitable mission as a nonprofit to fund the lavish lifestyles of its leaders and to buy the silence of former employees. Are you surprised by anything in this lawsuit?
Absolutely not. It's exactly the kind of dysfunction and financial malfeasance that Save the Second has been pointing out to NRA members. And many people, even before us, have pointed out for again, years, approaching decades now. There's been this known problem. These are publicly known issues. These are certainly issues that are known within the gun community. And they're issues that the board should have taken action on a long time ago. And I hope they do. I hope that they act swiftly. You know, no one who's been asking for reform at the NRA is celebrating the moves of the New York State Attorney General. I mean, it's quite embarrassing and frustrating, really. And maybe action by the board that has not been signaled yet, not been seen yet, could stave off the dissolution of what should be the greatest gun rights association in the world.
Okay, so you want to see action from the board, but the NRA released a statement. They called this lawsuit baseless, premeditated, an attack on our organization and the Second Amendment freedoms it fights to defend. They say it's all political. What is your response to that? But also, do you feel that there is any movement on the board, or do you think there's a consensus that this lawsuit is baseless?
I don't think there's a consensus that it's baseless. I do think there's a consensus that it's politically motivated. And those two things can exist at the same time. If the New York State Attorney General and the New York State government in general was pro-gun, you know, this might be a hushed phone call or a conversation, you know, on a private jet telling Wayne he's got to clean his act up or there's going to be trouble, especially if there was another administration in charge. So the consensus that it's political, yeah, I get it. I understand the emotional response to, you know, this is anti-gun, and it is. But unfortunately, Wayne LaPierre's leadership of the NRA is what's handed the keys to the office to Attorney General James so that she can be political with what is a dysfunctional system.
One action that the president is talking about is that the NRA should move to Texas. Do you think that this is a good course of action, or do you think there needs to be really an entirely new organization defending gun rights?
No, I absolutely am still in favor of and hopeful for an eventual NRA reform, even if it does come at the hands or the threat of dissolution or oversight from the New York State Attorney General's office. This is a national organization, and quite frankly, it's an internationally known and recognized gun rights organization that absolutely needs to be reformed. Merely running away from New York and doing the same thing in Texas or Arizona or Nevada or West Virginia even wouldn't make any difference. That's not going to solve the problems that have absolutely existed in Fairfax, Virginia, for this New York-based organization.
You want to see a cleaned up NRA, but do you worry that gun rights will be eroded without the NRA around? I mean, if this group is indeed disbanded.
No, I don't. It would send ripples that would have to be addressed inside of the gun community for sure. It would be seen as a victory by the anti-gun rights or the gun control side of the equation in America. But at the end of the day, there are over 110 million American gun owners, and there are many gun rights organizations at the state and federal level doing great work. Obviously, Save the Second and many of the people I'm aligned with in the gun community do not want to see the NRA dissolved or replaced. We want to see it reformed, rebuilt, and strengthened to be the greatest gun rights organization in the world.
That's Rob Pincus, Executive Director of the Personal Defense Network. Rob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Five years ago, Cori Bush took to the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, to protest the death of Michael Brown, an 18-year-old black man who was shot and killed by a white police officer. Bush was a new activist, charged by what she felt was a major injustice, one that she says she has seen many times in her life. Today, she is now a Democratic nominee for Missouri's 1st Congressional District, beating out longtime Representative William Lacey Clay in the state's primary.
They counted us out. They called me, you know, I'm just the protester. Uh-huh. I'm just the activist.
Come on. Come on.
With no name, no title, and no real money.
Come on. Yes.
That's all they said that I was. Yes.
Uh-huh.
But St. Louis showed up today. So.
Bush initially lost to Clay back in 2018. Her story was documented in the Netflix film Knock Down the House, which followed four primary challengers, including New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Cori Bush joins us now to talk about the significance of this primary win. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Cori, you're a pastor. You're a nurse. You were galvanized by the killing of Michael Brown, which happened just a few minutes from where you live. Now you're in this position to possibly make real political change. How does this moment feel?
It feels like a dream. I'm still trying to figure out what just happened, but I keep thinking about, wow, the change that we can make in this district, I'm just so excited about.
Your opponent, Representative Clay, is part of what a lot of folks call a political dynasty in Missouri. He served in Congress for 20 years. His father served a long time, too.
Yes.
And I want to play a clip from the documentary Knock Down the House, where you were talking to a voter back in 2018 who was actually surprised to hear you were actually running against Clay. Let's listen.
Yes.
Election time come around. Okay. Clay, that's one of the sure ones nobody even bothered looking at anything else.
Right.
I ain't really seen no Democrat with the guts to go up against the Clays in a long time.
With the guts to go up against the Clays in a long time is what he said. What changed in Missouri, do you think, that made voters want to give you a chance?
Well, first of all, people have seen me stay involved. I've stayed involved with the community. I, you know, hit the streets and running back during the Ferguson uprising. And then I ran for office. After I didn't win, I didn't leave. I continued to work. I continued to organize. I continued to use my voice and to also reach out and help the community. And then when you add COVID-19 and how it hit the St. Louis area, and then me being an essential worker, being a nurse, and then my own COVID-19 story that took me off the campaign trail in a way for 2 months, and then to move straight from that into organizing the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor protests locally, people just saw somebody that was willing to fight, and it's a new day. We got to see change.
I want to ask you about all of those things that you're talking about, this moment of racial reckoning that some are calling it, the pandemic, which you actually experienced firsthand, the impacts of COVID-19. What are some of your priorities as you enter the fall with all of this in the backdrop?
Yeah. So right now, just entering fall, I'll say making sure that we turn out the vote, making sure that people that feel disenfranchised about voting understand why we need them to show up. And then after that, once I'm elected, I want to push for more COVID-19 relief, $2,000 a month, universal basic income for every person over the age of 16, and making sure that we cancel utility shutoffs, making sure we have that moratorium on evictions. We have to put people in a position to be able to grow and thrive, because people were knocked down before COVID-19 hit. You know, now we have to do more. We have to help them to get to a place of just relief.
Mm. I want to ask you about one other thing. President Trump is currently sending 50 federal troops to St. Louis to combat violent crime. St. Louis typically has one of the highest murder per capita rates in the country, although it's in part because of the way the city limits are drawn. What Yes. are your thoughts on these federal agents coming, and how would you address gun violence in your district?
Right. Let me just say, I'm not in support of these agents coming to the St. Louis area. You know, I think that there are so many other things that we can do that we aren't doing. We always want to throw money at bringing more police or bringing more law enforcement into the communities, but we don't throw money at social workers. We don't throw money at therapists. We don't throw money at social programs. We don't throw money at recidivism programs. We don't throw money at making sure that people have a decent wage to be able to support themselves. But we always want to throw law enforcement in, because that's going to, you know, whip us into shape. I think that there is a way that we can stop this before we get here. Yes, I do understand that St. Louis had 53 murders in just the month of July alone. That is outrageous. But it's not like it just happened. We've been fighting this for a very long time. Donald Trump wants to send these federal agents to St. Louis. Let me just say, the people of St. Louis deserve better. The people of St. Louis deserve care, treatment, rehab, if that's what we need. We deserve to be treated like anyone else. You know, we are not a bad community. We are a community of people who love one another and want to see St. Louis thrive. We have some issues, but those issues didn't just start yesterday. This is systematic racism, and it's so many other things that have caused us to get here.
That's Cori Bush, winner of Missouri's first district congressional primary this week. If elected, Bush will be the first Black woman to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives from Missouri. Cori, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
President Trump is taking another hit today at the popular apps TikTok and WeChat. And let's start with our social media roundup on that note with Femi Okeh, who is host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. And Femi, President Trump issued executive orders against TikTok and WeChat to effectively ban them in the U.S. And this will take effect in 45 days. He claims the Chinese-owned internet app threatens national security. What are users saying about this?
Well, there has been some confusion from TikTok users in the US about the platform. Is it actually going away? TikTok posted on Twitter in a TikTok video, stay with me, that they are not going anywhere. Fans are very relieved and candid. Maya, for instance, says, I know TikTok is kind of toxic because of the drama, but we still love the app. It's our home. Mm-hmm. Some deeper analysis from Lisa Suhey. She sarcastically observes in a TikTok video, of course, that during a global pandemic, the only reason the president could be focusing on TikTok is to help his election chances. But in that debate, support for the president, Mbox, for instance, celebrates the president's executive order. Mbox says, glad to see this app gone. I don't want an app that spies on people. And I wasn't sure that Mbox had even looked at TikTok until he said this. An app that got many underage girls to twerk. Okay, he's definitely seen TikTok.
Wow. Okay. Let's talk about another big story. Your feed has also been full of people sharing their back to school experiences during this pandemic. What are you seeing from students?
Oh, so much. Let's just think. Social media, students, phones, going back to school in a global pandemic. We're going to get so much in terms of documentation. I've seen pictures of the first day of school, everybody crowded together, happy to see each other. Of course, now we know about COVID-19. Those pictures are quite triggering. TikTok videos, TikTok again. Kay Kemi says, under her video, when you're the only one wearing a mask in your class, and you see a whole bunch of students and only one person wearing a mask. And then this story went viral. A couple of students in Georgia took pictures and video of their first day at school. And those pictures went viral and people were really shocked because it didn't look like it was any other time than a normal school day. People wandering around, bumping into each other super close. Hannah said there'll probably be about 10% mask rate. The posts were picked up. They were shared widely. And Hannah and another student were suspended for showing what was happening in their school. And then I looked at Hannah's feed this morning and it says, this morning my school called and they've deleted my suspension. To everyone supporting me, I can't thank you enough. If I'm not responding, it's because my life has been somewhat crazy the past few days. Once again, thank you. Thousands of people shared that. They retweeted that. They supported her because she was basically saying it is not safe in our school right now during COVID-19. And her school was very unhappy that that information was made public.
You know, it's really interesting because it gives us a window into the realities of what school might look like once it's in full swing throughout the nation. And teenagers with their phones can actually show us with these pictures.
Yep,
you
exactly.
actually shared with us that one school principal in Alabama, Dr. Quentin Lee, is trying to make the best of all of this situation with the COVID-19 parody dance video. And it now has 5 million views on YouTube.
Oh, it's so good. So Dr. Lee took the music from MC Hammer's You Can't Touch This and then turned it into a parody video. But it was an educational one, of course. He is a principal in Alabama. And it was things like he was spraying the lockers and he was telling people, don't use the photocopier. Put your gloves on first. He had
Can't
a ruler
this,
for 6 feet distancing. I mean, social distancing has never looked so much fun. And people really appreciated that it was such a difficult time for school students and for teachers. And he made the lessons that they had to learn to be safe. He made
we have a little
lot
bit of
fun.
It. We can have folks listen to just a bit of it.
Why are y'all standing so close? Back up.
Every there you go. Vimy, okay.
It's so good.
Yeah, so good. Your host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. As always, Vimy, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
It's here and now.
I don't want to be sick. I've been to all the classroom from upstairs into the gym. It's Lee. Go Lee. Dr. Lee. Yo, Doc, you're late. Look at.
The number of people who are infected with the coronavirus is rising across some sparsely populated parts of the Midwest and the Great Plains. Missouri, Oklahoma, and Montana are all seeing spikes in cases. Montana largely sat out the eruption of coronavirus cases across the country earlier this year, so the state had time to prepare. But it seems it wasn't enough time. As cases now rise in Montana, the new nationwide testing backlog is hampering the state's ability to keep up. Yellowstone Public Radio's Nikki Ouellette reports.
Since the start of July, Montana, population just north of 1 million, has averaged at least 17,000 coronavirus tests a week, many of them processed by the national lab company Quest Diagnostics. That allowed the state to offer free testing to anyone who wanted it, in elder care facilities, multi-generational homes on Native American reservations, and in some counties. People going in for surgery were screened, so were employees in and around newly reopened Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks. Then Quest hit a backlog.
Some of the testing results are just coming through on testing that we did back July 11th.
Kim Bailey is a public health nurse in Yellowstone County, now the epicenter of the pandemic in Montana. She says testing asymptomatic people can reveal new cases in places health authorities don't necessarily expect the virus to be, and it was finding a few new cases. But a 3-week lag on results meant sick people were still out and about, and contact tracing was delayed. Now, most asymptomatic testing around the state is on pause until other private labs and a state university can ramp up to meet demand. The state health lab can return results in 2 to 3 days, but it doesn't have capacity to keep testing people without symptoms. The stall in testing hit as cases mushroomed from a total of 500 at the end of May to more than 4,000 today.
It was overwhelming.
Bailey recently hired on a small army of contact tracers to try to stay ahead of the outbreak by making calls like this one.
Any salons, getting your hair done, nails done? No. Nope. Barbecues, picnics, or family dinners? No weddings, baby showers, no workout classes.
Contact tracing has revealed a lot of new cases, and the number of contacts per case has ballooned since Governor Steve Bullock lifted the state's stay-home order April 26th. But lots of people don't get calls like this when there's a big delay in test results. Health officials say successful contact tracing means the authorities can surgically target interventions to certain types of events or businesses instead of using the blunt instrument of broad closure orders. Governor Steve Bullock supports that approach.
There's no doubt that the news that we'd have to delay some upcoming community snapshot testing events took us backwards at a time when we're making significant progress in reaching our testing targets here in Montana.
Quest Diagnostics cleared its backlog of Montana tests this week after Bullock turned to North Carolina-based Mako Medical to process 10,000 tests for the state since late July. He also reached an agreement with Montana State University, which says it will soon have capacity to run another 500 tests a day. In the face of inconsistent testing capacity, Bullock is focusing on 9 hotspot counties that he says may need more resources or local health restrictions. He says current masking and social distancing restrictions would work if people followed them. Health officials say they're also facing challenges from people not following orders to isolate or refusing to share their contacts. For NPR News, I'm Nikki Ouellette in Yellowstone County.
The presidential election is just 88 days away, and the coming days are important for Democrats. Next week, presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden is expected to announce his running mate. And the week after that, the Democratic National Convention. We want to take a minute now to look at some of Biden's policy proposals. And we have with us Asma Khalid, who is political correspondent for NPR, and she's been covering the Biden campaign. Welcome.
Hey there.
So, Asma, I want to start with the pandemic. Biden has criticized President Trump's handling of efforts to fight COVID-19. How is Biden proposing to get things under control if elected?
Yeah, I mean, I will say, Tanya, this has been one of his key proposals. I go back to March, one of the last in-person events that I attended, that was sort of a bigger-ish rally that Joe Biden held, was to deal with the pandemic. He outlined a plan. Then back in June, he again had an event that I was at where he outlined this 5-step plan in Delaware, where he was talking about different things that he thinks needs to be done. You know, he's talked extensively about the need to scale up testing. He feels like we as a country need to have a plan where personal protective equipment is available for any healthcare worker who needs that equipment. He's also talked about the fact that we need to accelerate vaccine plans and make the distribution of that vaccine more clearly and transparently accessible to people, and that the country needs to have a consistent message on mask wearing. And lastly, Tanya, he's also talked about the need to boost Social Security and SNAP payments for people who are at high risk. He feels like this is, you know, not just an issue of a public health crisis, but also an economic issue.
Yeah, he's also talking about, in regards to the economics of it, creating something called a public health job corps. This is interesting because it would employ people out of work to help fight this virus. What other specific plans is he really offering to improve the economy?
Yeah, I mean, I will say a lot of what we have heard from him recently has been about building back the economy. You know, we all know when we look at the unemployment numbers and other economic indicators that this...
It looks like we might have lost Asma Khalid. Asma is a political correspondent with NPR, and she's been talking with us about the Biden campaign. We will try to get her again. We have her back. The beauty of live radio.
Oh, my gosh.
So we're talking specifically about the economy and some of the ways that this presidential nominee is taking this on.
And sorry about that, Tanya, but hopefully I will not cut out again. I was saying that he's talked about some of the immediate steps he feels that the federal government can do in terms of providing state and local government with aid so that they can provide that information to essential workers or educators. And he's also talked about extended crisis unemployment insurance to people who are currently out of work. In the more long-term sense, though, he's also outlined an agenda that he calls Buy American. This is, I think, really an interesting political move in contrast to President Trump's America First agenda. And he's talked about the need to buy goods that are made in America so that in the future, if there was not necessarily a public health crisis, but any type of national crisis, the country would not be relying on important materials or pharmaceuticals from foreign countries. And he's outlined a pretty extensive plan, calling for, say, $300 billion in additional research and development for this Made in America agenda.
Let's talk a little bit about something else, and that's police reform. So some on the left have called for the defunding of police, but Biden and a lot of Democrats as well say that they don't want that. This week, he told donors he actually wants more money for the police to enact reforms to that institution. Where does he stand on policing?
Yeah, Tanya, he doesn't have a specific initiative on policing per se, but he has put out a plan on broader criminal justice issues. He talks a lot about the need to invest more in community policing. He's called for a $300 million additional investment. He's also talked about the need for the Justice Department to address some of the systemic misconduct that the country has seen in local police departments across the country. And I think what's really notable, Tanya, is that, you know, he has a fairly long list of policies he claims that he'll get to in the first 100 days. But he specifically has called for a police oversight body that he says he will set up in his first 100 days. And, you know, a lot of this, I think, is also important for the vice president politically, because there are certainly members of the Democratic Party, folks on the progressive left, who remember his legacy in bringing about the 1994 crime bill.
Right.
We still have no questions about Biden's role around some of these policing issues. And there's decently a lot of skepticism, I will say, specifically when I talk to young voters.
What about larger efforts towards racial equity? He said a couple of statements that many people have taken issue with over the last few days. What is he promising?
When it comes to racial equity, Tanya, I would say a lot of his focus has been on economic equality. He's outlined some plans that will call for additional investments around public-private venture capital to Black and brown entrepreneurs. He's called for additional money as well for low-interest business loans. And what I think is, you know, an interesting nugget, which I hadn't heard so much about prior to this, was he actually called specifically for the Fed, the Federal Reserve, to start focusing more on racial economic gaps and collecting that information and making that sort of a higher priority. And so I will say a lot of the racial economic justice issues that he has highlighted most recently have focused on economic plans.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about some other plans, including child care and adult caregiving. So Biden spoke in Newcastle, Delaware recently about how he wants to expand access, and he announced a plan that includes nearly $800 billion towards this, which would aid in reducing the cost of child care for kids under five. Let's listen.
Low and middle income families won't spend more than 7% of their income on child care for children under the age of five. The most hard-pressed working families won't have to spend a dime.
This, of course, is a topic that's very important to families in the United States, and it's something that many administrations have tried to tackle over several administrations. Can you tell us more about this specific plan?
Sure. You know, he's called for universal pre-K for all 3- and 4-year-olds. And he's also promised, as we heard there, that a number of low and middle income families would essentially face a cap, that they would not have to pay out-of-pocket expenses for child care beyond a certain amount. I think there are certainly a lot of questions from Republicans about how you would pay for such an extensive plan. And at this point in time, we've heard primarily from the vice president about the need, from his view, to roll back some of President Trump's tax cuts. And that is how he envisions paying for much of this child care plan.
With the little bit of time that I have left with you, immigration, of course, is a topic that Trump ran on the last election. Biden has spoken quite a bit about it. He told NPR he wouldn't tear down any parts of the border wall constructed by this current administration, but he wouldn't build more. So where does he stand on immigration? What is he campaigning on with this topic?
Well, Tanya, this is another issue that he promises to tackle within essentially his first 100 days. He says that he will put forward a comprehensive immigration reform bill. He has also pledged that he will have put a moratorium on deportations. This is, again, some issue that I will say folks on the progressive left of the party have had skepticism about where the vice president is. Bernie Sanders definitely attracted more of a sort of a following specifically among immigration activists during the primary cycle. But Joe Biden has tried to address some of the concerns from folks within the left of his own party as we've been moving closer to the November election.
With the 30 seconds I have with you, what population is he most focused on right now in his fight to win in November?
That's such an interesting question. You know, Tanya, I often say to people that there is what I would call a Joe Biden coalition. And that coalition is combined of, you know, anti-Trump Republicans, African-American activists. It's a very hodgepodge group of people. And the singular common focus they have is they want to defeat President Trump. I don't know that there's that much else in common amongst all of them.
NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid, as always, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Most of us know a Deadhead. Fans of the legendary counterculture rock group The Grateful Dead are everywhere, even though the group's founding father and principal songwriter is gone. Jerry Garcia died 25 years ago this Sunday. And as Colorado Public Radio's Vic Vella reports, his music lives on.
Every Grateful Dead fan will tell you about their first show, their most cherished bootleg, and their favorite version of Dark Star, even if you weren't asking. Because being a Deadhead is all about the music that brings joy for millions. But every fan also remembers the worst day in Grateful Dead history, August 9th, 1995.
Jerry Garcia, the Grateful Dead guitarist who kept the counterculture of the 1960s rocking and rolling right into the 90s, died today in California. He was 53.
Garcia was at a rehab center trying to kick a long-time heroin addiction, but his body just wasn't up to it. That night, Grateful Dead founding member Bob Weir performed with his side band Rat Dog in New Hampshire. You could hear the emotion in his voice.
We are on our own!
Probably didn't do a proper job of grieving, because what I did was I came back, I attended the memorial services and all that kind of stuff, and then went straight back out on the road and stayed there.
Garcia's death left a void in the hearts of Deadheads.
Like I told you, what I said, steal your face right off your
But 25 years after Jerry's death, the Grateful Dead's music lives on. Remarkably so. And younger musicians are tapping into Garcia's songbook.
In the timbers of Fenario, the wolves are running around.
Billy Strings is a bluegrass phenom who wasn't even 3 years old when Garcia died. He admits it took him a little while to get used to the Dead's signature of improvisation and long instrumental jams.
At first I was like, man, it sounds like five people playing five different songs, you know, like, why don't they just play a song?
Now Strings often covers the Dead at his shows. He says he loves that the Dead never tried to be perfect. They only had one top 10 single in their career, and their studio albums weren't received all that well either. Strings says that's what makes the band so endearing.
It's real music, it's honest, it's authentic, and it's like, the rough edges are okay. In fact, those are human characteristics.
Garcia and the Dead's music continues to be celebrated by bands like Bob Weir's Dead & Company and Joe Russo's Almost Dead. And you could argue Jerry Garcia's music is more accessible now than it ever was before. You see, back in the day, Deadheads had to travel the country and swap cassette bootlegs of Dead shows to hear the band's music. Now, every show is available online at their fingertips. David Lemieux handles the Grateful Dead's archives.
And I've had a few people kind of question. I was like, well, you know, I'm only 21 and I never saw the Dead. I go to lots of Dead & Company shows. I buy the Dave's Picks. You know, am I like really a Deadhead? I said, of course you are. There's so much room on this bus.
These days, Jerry Garcia's and the Dead's music remains a staple at live events. Billy Strings.
If you go to a festival, any campground you walk through, you're going to hear some dude on the guitar playing Friend of the Devil. You know what I mean? You're just going to hear it. And I love that.
Nowadays, Bob Weir says he doesn't really miss Garcia, because Jerry never left him.
He's kind of live and kicking in my heart. We grew up together, and we became part of each other. Just because his physical body is gone doesn't mean that the part of me that he's part of, that didn't die with him, with his physical body. Sit out one, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight,
just might get some sleep tonight. And that love for and legacy of Jerry Garcia will not fade away. For Here and Now, I'm Vic Vella.
You just heard from Jerry Garcia's longtime Grateful Dead bandmate, Bob Weir. These days, Weir has a lot of time on his hands. His band, Dead & Company, can't tour because of the pandemic.
I miss that. I miss that big. At the same time, I can't just ignore what the medical community has to say about COVID and go ahead and play anyway, because that would be grossly irresponsible.
So Weir has launched an organization, Music for Masks. It's aimed at getting masks to underserved communities. They're asking musicians and fans to donate things like concert tour t-shirts to repurpose them into masks.
If you want live music in your life, what we, the performing musicians, have to say is do your part to bring us back out on the road and wear a mask for the time being until we can get this thing beat back.
If you've got a concert t-shirt to donate, you can contact Music for Masks through our website, hereandnow.org. Got a wife in Chino, babe, and one in Cherokee. First one say she got my child, but it don't look like me. Set out, run, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine.